It is a great pleasure for my latest nostalgia interview to meet Sally Bernard here at Deal in East Kent. And Sally, do you want to tell me a little bit about, it's always difficult, isn't it, to sum up your life in just a few sentences, but what would you say are the most sort of distinguishing things that you've done in your distinguished life?
Well, I think actually becoming a teacher, because it opened a door for everything else that happened afterwards. I taught for many years, but also I went into all sorts of other things. I became an adult tutor. I looked after tutors themselves. I did family learning. All these things came out of being a teacher.
And was teaching something that you knew that you always wanted to do? Or was
no,
that...
it wasn't no. something I wanted to do particularly. It was something my father wanted me to do. I wanted to run an antique shop, actually, if I remember rightly. And he said there was no money in that. Then I wanted to become a speech therapist. I thought that he might like that. No, it was too expensive. Why don't you go to teacher's training college? I've just had a girl in my surgery, because he was a doctor, who went to college at Bishop Otter in Sussex. And I think you should go there. But I'd rather go to London if I've got to be a teacher. No, you've got boyfriends in London. That's no good. I think you need to go to Chichester. So I ended up in Chichester.
So home for you, was it in Sussex?
So No, it wasn't Sussex.
Good grief. Yeah.
No, I was born in Bristol.
Oh.
Bristol is where I come from. And I went to school in Bristol. I went to Clifton High School in Bristol. Long, long time ago now. I still get the blurb through from the school, because I am a lifelong member, but it's now co-educational and it's gone downhill, yeah, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah. I always find, when you were talking about your father not wanting you to work in antiques and not happy about you being a speech therapist, I'm a real believer that sometimes if you're passionate about doing something, you kind of will end up doing it somehow anyway, maybe not at the time you expect it to, but it sounds like teaching may not have been the ideal thing, but you did kind of make the most of it. But maybe you shaped the job in a way that you couldn't have foreseen when you started out.
That's very true. I did make the most of it. Mind you, my mother was Welsh, and so as you well know, it's a nation of school teachers. She always said that my son should marry a Welsh school teacher, which he did. So there you go.
Yeah. Where in Wales was she from?
She was from Merthyr Tydfil. Oh. Long time ago now.
Yeah, well, a part of the world that I know a little bit. Is that Cardiff is where I'm from. And I mean, the teaching, I think, is worth sticking with, because it sounds like you were doing more than simply imparting information. You were doing something. It sounds like it was more about human flourishing. It sounds as though you were helping people in a way that...
I was helping lots of mothers and things, teaching them how to play with their children. So many kids didn't even have birthday parties because their mothers said they couldn't afford them.
Yeah.
And that's what I used to do with Sure Start. Actually, Sure Start was a very good thing that the government brought in, but it was abused. When I went up to London, I saw how abused it was, because I went to various meetings as I was working in family learning then. I went to various meetings with the Sure Start, and they were just giving away the money to anybody they fancied. It wasn't thought about. And that's why it failed, I think.
And has education been something about which you've been passionate all your working life?
Well, it's something I've been involved in all my working life. Education, I suppose, yes. Yes.
What do you think started that? Because when you mentioned that your father, you know, perhaps of the options available, being a school teacher was one of them. Did you resent it at the time? Were you sort of like, oh, why do I have to do this? Or did you think, okay, well, I'm going to prove that I'm going to be amazing at this?
No, I didn't. I resented it, actually, at the time. But I must admit, things have gone on a bit. When I heard that Glenys Kinnock had died yesterday, I must admit, I remembered how she had gone through a phase of wanting everybody to learn reading by osmosis. And it doesn't work like that. I had a boy as I was telling Tuppence earlier, I had a boy who was useless at reading, couldn't read at all, and he was trying to read Robin Hood or something, a very complicated book. And then I had a very bright boy who was just being lazy, really, and he was reading Dr. Seuss, all because she said that they could read by osmosis, and we weren't supposed to challenge them or move them on or anything else. It was so frustrating being a supply teacher.
Yeah. What does reading by osmosis mean exactly? Is it more that they can sort of randomly choose what they do without any sort of overarching curriculum?
Yes. And they're supposed to learn by actually absorbing the facts, not by any means that they did, because they didn't. As I said, you know, there was this boy who was totally lazy. And I think his reading Dr. Seuss was lazy.
But it's one of those things, isn't it, that a lot of people at school, friends of mine, reading Shakespeare at the age of 11 or 12, and it put them off Shakespeare for life, because at that particular moment they weren't quite ready for it. And you know, they'd have a teacher who'd say, no, that's the wrong answer to the question, or that's the wrong view to hold. And yet those same people, maybe as adults, may have found a different way into Shakespeare, because there's no teacher sort of standing over them and telling them off if they got the interpretation wrong.
I remember thinking that if I was going to be a teacher, I wouldn't put my children through the schooling that I had had, that I would try and be a better teacher and try and do something for them. And I think I did, actually, because I don't think there was a single one in my class who couldn't read at the end of moving up, as it were. Funnily enough, there are two teachers here who lived round the corner from where I first started work in Kent, believe it or not, in Eisted Rise. That was where I first taught. And they lived in Eisted Rise itself, and they remembered the name of the headmistress, which I'd forgotten.
Yeah. That sounds phenomenal, because when people sometimes go into a profession that maybe they've been encouraged to go into or inspired to go into by, for example, one of their own teachers, they end up copying them, emulating them, with all the bad examples as well as the good ones. But it sounds like in your case, you actively sought to undo what had happened,
yes,
what you'd been taught.
I did.
To talk me through that process, because that's not easy, and that's not what everyone does.
Well, I don't quite know how it happened, but I decided that I was going to be a good teacher, not a bad teacher.
Yeah.
And so I was a good teacher, I think. And I was a good teacher with my children as well, I hope. I got them interested in things. And Tuppence still remembers Open University. I used to do Open University, eventually. And she remembers opening all the packages, which, quite frankly, I was too tired to open. I had too much to do to open the packages, but she opened the packages for me. And she often said that it was her first degree. I think it was too, actually, if I think about it. She taught me an awful lot.
And it sounds like she was very young at the time that she was watching this.
Yes.
I remember the Open University, it'd be on BBC Two at like 12:30.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And Adrian was wonderful. He used to get up early and record everything for me, which was fantastic. My parents were a bit surprised that I went and did Open University, but I didn't finish until my father was dead, unfortunately. But my mother and my aunt came to my graduation ceremony in Brighton. I can remember being very proud of that. But of course, it didn't really affect my work, because at that time, it didn't really affect your work.
And also, I know from my own grandfather's case, his mother was a teacher, and she had to stop being a teacher when she got married. And then when she was widowed, she was allowed to return to the teaching profession. But in extraordinary days.
They were extraordinary days. And my mother was the same. She was a nurse. And when she married my father, she had to stop being a nurse, because that was what you did. If you were a wife, you became a housewife. And there wasn't much to do about it. But actually, I don't remember that very much about that. I don't remember that Adrian was encouraging me to do all sorts of things, and so I did. But I worked part-time most of the time because I had the family to raise, and he was away such a lot. So most of the things I did was part-time.
Did you witness lots of changes during the time that you were a teacher, so that in terms of the way that teachers were treated, in terms of the social status of the teachers, the like we were just saying there about if you were married, you weren't allowed to teach. But did you find in your own experience, I know that was an earlier generation, but did you sort of find that the role of the teacher changed during the time that you were in the profession?
It did tremendously, because when I taught originally, I used to have just a class of relatively bright children, and then they anybody with autism or ADHD was siphoned off to to a special school, and then they stopped the special schools, and so you had they all came back into the classroom, as it were, and that was hard work. It became very, very hard work. I mean, my daughter-in-law has 17 different nationalities in her class now. It's a lot, isn't it, to cope with, I think. And she doesn't have any help. And I think that's awfully hard, because not only does she have the different nationalities, but she also has the children with problems, the ones who sit and scream the whole time, and the ones who can't cope with life, as generally speaking. These kids in my day were all siphoned off, you see.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there was a model of education which really meant that you sat and you listened. And if you couldn't sit still, you were seen to be a disruptive presence, a remedial child. So the children who couldn't learn through conventional means were deemed to be problem children. They were humiliated
by the system, and they were thrown out. And they went to the special schools, and you didn't see anything more of them. Any child who was a problem, I can remember in my first year being given a child who was a problem to one teacher, but she responded to me beautifully because I had been very tidy and I was very sort of, this is your peg and nobody's going to take things away from you. This is where you belong and this is where you hang your things. Well, she'd never had that before in the other classroom. It was just so messy because the teacher herself was messy. That she didn't settle, but she settled when she came to me because she knew where she stood.
And all these years on, are there any, not necessarily directly, you know, in contact with, but have you followed through?
No, I haven't.
You haven't had that chance?
No, my daughter did, my younger daughter. She actually contacted a lot of the kids that were at Orfold School, which is where I taught finally. Because she came there for a short time. She'd left school both my girls had trouble at school, and they both left term, before the end of term, as it were. And so they came to be with me. Tubbins learnt to be a tour guide in Bermuda because I was working then as a education coordinator at the Aquarium Museum and Zoo. And Lucy came to Orfold School, where she met up with a lot of the pupils and still keeps in touch with them, I believe. I don't know.
Yeah. And I want to turn to I don't know if you went on all those world journeys that he went on, but certainly Bermuda is where the whole family lived for several years. Was this in the 1980s?
We lived there for 6 years, yes, about that time. Yeah. And I was worked in a nursery there, which wasn't very satisfactory. And then I worked as a community education officer for the museum, aquarium and zoo, which was great fun. I enjoyed that very much and started a lot of things which I hope are still carrying on today. I don't know whether they are, but they were when I was last out there, shall we put it like this.
Yeah.
And as I got to the gate last time, I was let in for nothing because the girl recognised me. She said, "Oh, you're bringing your kids, are you?" And I said, "Yes." So she said, "Okay, off you go." So I went in for nothing and took them round, which was nice. But I always knew that on Thursdays, Adrian did Rotary Club because he was a Rotarian. And on Thursdays, my boss at the aquarium had been to Rotary the night before, and round table it was, actually, not Rotary, beg your pardon. And they'd drunk so much, the men, the night before, that I always knew I could get whatever I wanted on Thursday mornings. So I did.
Yeah. Well, we might come back to that later on. I'll prize that one out of you. But tell me a bit before we move on to those big international ventures. I'm curious, so growing up in Bristol, in terms of the culture of the day, so education obviously played a big role in your life, professionally, not least. But are there particular memories you have from growing up? Anything from growing up in Bristol that particularly stands out? Memories that you associate with your childhood, for example?
Bristol?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about Bristol. My parents had been through... My father had been through a very bad war, and my mother had sort of kept the home fires burning, but that's beside the point. As you know very well, that generation had difficulty in raising their kids, but we were so lucky to be raised in peace, as it were. I remember the house that we lived in, and I remember going across to the tennis courts across a very high wall. We used to walk along this high wall, which was a sheer drop on one side. I couldn't do it now, but obviously I could do it then. And to go play tennis. That's all I remember, yeah, really, about Bristol.
Yeah. What about things like music or movies? Because I have this abiding memory of things like the charts when I was growing up, the music that I listened to, the records that I bought.
Well, I had some friends who came from Sweden. My mother was a great believer in world friends, as she called them, as they were known then, whereby you took people into your homes from various countries and you promoted England towards them. And so that they would become your friend and then there would be no war. That was what my mother believed, anyway. And so we had people from Germany and from Finland and from Sweden. And they were all very disappointed that we didn't live near King's Road.
Because that was the London that they identified with.
That's right, yes.
The fashion.
That's right. That was the fashionable place. And why didn't I go to London? And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't go to London. I don't sort of move around very much. But I know that having the German boy was a great difficulty for my parents because my father had such a bad war and he was a very difficult person. I remember him sitting there and saying, 'I don't eat sheep,' when my mother put roast lamb in front of him. And this Finnish girl next door to him pushing his plate back and, 'If Mrs. Butcher says you eat sheep, you eat sheep.' Because they had to speak English together. They were from Finland and Germany. So I don't know whether that worked.
Yes. So maybe the strategy was that if there was dialogue, they'd all get on much better. But it sounds as though there were a few teething issues.
There were a few teething issues, I think. But my father was very brave about it all.
Well, was that a common thing? Was this sort of post-war? Was this an attempt to try and make sure that there wasn't a World War III?
I think there was an attempt that there shouldn't be a World War III. I don't quite know. I mean, they were so adamant that it wouldn't ever happen again, my parents. They were so...
Especially if your parents had lived through both of the World Wars.
They hadn't. Well, I don't know whether my father had been born, actually.
Mm.
He was a medical officer in Belsen. And that's what I think really knocked him for six. And my mother had been a nurse, as they say, in St Mary's in hospital in London, but had to give it up when she married my father.
Do you think society has changed enough in the last, in the generation that you're referring to?
I think it has. It has changed enormously.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, technology, for example, has advanced so much. I mean, I remember there not being mobile phones. I remember all sorts of things like that. No internet, no nothing like that. And suddenly you've got it all at your fingertips, as it were. I still don't know how to use it.
Yeah. And my parents are the same. They don't have Wi-Fi, they don't have internet, they have nothing. No cable or satellite TV, no computers.
Right.
Just a standard mobile phone, no smartphones.
No, that's very good, actually. And I think that's the way a lot of people are. Certainly, I find it very difficult coping now, because now with Adrian with Alzheimer's, I've got to learn all these things, and all has to be done online now.
Yes.
And it's hard to learn things at 73. You know, if I'd learnt them when I was younger, it would have been a lot easier. And I don't think people realise that.
It's so easy to be caught out, I think. I mean, I think of my grandfather, who, he always referred to himself as, he was born in 1920 and he lived to 95. And he always referred to himself as like a compulsive buyer. So if there was some like latest technology, he'd be up for it. But he wouldn't always know how to use it. And I think that the idea of it was good. But he'd still be using a checkbook sort of thing, you know, at a time when everyone was using their cards.
Well, I still use a checkbook, yeah. I have to say.
Yeah.
So there you are, I take after him.
Yeah.
And actually, checks are still valid and people still want them.
Yeah.
So I don't think they are outmoded like the banks say. In fact, the banks are making a U-turn about checkbooks and things like that, I think. I think technology is going to kill itself.
Yeah, that's a thread worth looking at, because you made me think of the time I went to university in the very early 90s when we didn't have mobile phones. I mean, they existed, but certainly not in Lamperton, which is where I was studying. So there was no opportunity back then for us to communicate. But we managed. Of course we managed. Because looking back, we wonder how we managed. But of course, at the time, it's not as though we knew what we were missing.
No. And you had phones and you had the post, which is, of course, I still use, funnily enough. I still write letters to my friends and to my grandson at York University. And I think it's important to keep writing as much as you can. Keep in touch with people, not just through the internet.
And have you kept these letters? I mean, I don't mean the ones that you're talking about recently in York, but is that something you've done all your life? And have you always kept all of those letters?
No, I haven't kept the letters. I'm sorry about that. I haven't kept. I've kept a few of my husband's letters from when he was courting me, believe it or not. Years ago, but I haven't kept any other letters. Well, I've kept the odd one, my father's last letter to me and that sort of thing. But I did have all the Bermuda letters that my mother had sent me. She'd sent to me twice a week she sent letters to me. And I kept them all religiously. And they were all in a chest of drawers at my mother's house. And my sister threw them out the week before I came back. Because I was going to use them to make a sort of story for my children of what our years in Bermuda, but I couldn't, obviously, because they'd gone.
Mm.
So it was a shame.
That must have been devastating.
Well, it was a great shame. I understood what my sister wanted, the chest of drawers, but on the other hand, I was cross with my mother that she hadn't held on to the letters carefully.
There's one thing that I did, and more recently, because my parents have always kept the letters I sent them and vice versa. But in old diary entries, I might have said, wrote a letter to my parents this afternoon. In later years, I've been able to annotate all those old diaries and add in the letter. You know, actually, that would involve writing out the letter, because it was obviously a written letter in those days. And I annotate my diaries on a computer. But actually having that original source, and often if it's banal stuff that's in there, you know, what I had for lunch that day, it's precious, because it's a time and place that's being
evoked. It is a time and place. And so I did keep a record of it all.
Yeah.
And I have kept records of all our holidays and all the travelling we've done, believe it or not. I've still got written records of all that.
Of all the places you've been, which are the ones, I mean, Bermuda, obviously, we've touched on already, but which are the ones that made the biggest impression?
Well, New Zealand, I think, because I'd always wanted to go there, always. My father would take me to a presentation of New Zealand when I was still at school, and I think that that's the presentations that they used to do in those days. They were trying to get people to go out there and live. And I remember wanting to go and live there with Adrian when he first qualified. And he wouldn't go because he said that they didn't earn very much money. And so we didn't go. But he kept his promise, and later on we went. It was sort of 40 years later, but we still went.
Yeah, and did it live up to the expectations?
Yes, it did.
I went to Hawaii once, and of course, when you start reading, there was a novel I read called Paradise News, and it's about a theologian and his father who goes to Hawaii. Then I went there, and of course, I was expecting it to be like the novel, although the novel itself was full of, you know, points of tension and dissonance. It's not the way that you know, they imagined it. But see, when you went to New Zealand, how did that fit with the ideal that maybe you built up?
Well, I think originally we were a bit disappointed with New Zealand, but when I got to Akaria, which is sort of on a peninsula outside Christchurch, that is superb. And that's, we got over the hill in the car and suddenly looking down on this, it was New Zealand. It was wonderful. I think Adrian has kept a picture of that. And we loved New Zealand after that. And it certainly did live up to expectations, actually. It was great.
How long did you live there?
We only went there for 3 months. Yeah. But it was long enough, I suppose. He was ready to come home. And I came home too. But I think it's the one place that Adrian would love to go back to if he could. But I don't think he will be able to do anything like that now.
Yes, there's always something, isn't there, about the exotic. And sometimes I found that about university as well. That sometimes going back can also be a problem. You know, not just the places, going to somewhere that you haven't been. It's just a different side of the coin to going back to somewhere where you once lived, and whether you're okay with processing the inevitable change and the fact that the people who populate it are no longer perhaps there.
It's very interesting, actually, because our old house in Bristol went up for sale recently, and it was on for £1 million. And they had done all the things to it that I said my parents should do to it in days gone by. And, of course, there was nothing of us left there. But it was interesting to see that. I like revisiting the past in many respects. We had a little house in Bristol, Adrian and I, for the first 9 years of our lives. Where the children were born in Bristol, actually. Well, Ian and Tuppence were. Lucy was born in Bermuda. She was our Bermuda baby.
Yeah. How do you feel about going back to Bristol? Because obviously it's not that far away, relatively speaking.
Well, no, I have been back to Bristol, and it was very interesting. I went with some Tasmanian friends of mine, and I remember telling them that, no, they thought they knew their way around, and I said, no, you don't know your way around. So I did know my way around.
But often it's the outsider perspective. I always find that, and you see it in films sometimes, when somebody who's making a film from outside of that country, I think of Ang Lee, who made Sense and Sensibility, you know, a Taiwanese filmmaker making a quintessentially, you know, Jane Austen adaptation, brings a completely different slant that anybody else could have brought. But also when you're in a place that you're familiar with, like Bristol, and you go there with somebody from Tasmania, then, of course, they're going to be pointing out things that you may have just taken for granted, or maybe they'll spot things that you would never have looked for. And suddenly you realise that this notion of home, this place that you associate with your childhood, is open to a whole new set of interpretations.
No, not interpretations, I don't think.
Okay.
It had changed, and I just sort of accepted them. I don't really worry about things being different in that respect. I just knew my way around, as I would know my way around in Bermuda.
Yeah.
Still.
I always find it funny. I remember I used to walk, when I was living in West Wales, and even when I first moved to Canterbury, It would be about a 20-minute walk from where I was living to the place where I worked. And I'd do that journey every single day. But looking back now, I can't remember it very clearly. And yet there are places I've only been to once, and I can remember it far more vividly. It's left a more indelible impression in my consciousness than those places that I did, you know, every single day. And I can never quite work out why that is.
I don't know why that is either, actually. Except that I suppose I'm very good at remembering where I've been and what things look like, I suppose. Yes. Which is useful, actually. It was useful when Adrian could drive the car. I do miss the fact that we don't have a car now, because we don't do very much. And I know that I'm getting a little bit odd.
It's one of those moments, isn't it, when you look back, and it's often, it's not definable. But there's a point sometimes when suddenly you start to think, hang on a minute, you know, once upon a time there would have been that option or that option, but suddenly things look very different, a different sort of lens. Maybe it's an age thing, I don't know. There's a part of me that also wants to battle against that and say, right, I'm 50, and I want to do the things now at 50.
You should do them while you can.
Yeah.
Please.
Because there are things that I really wanted to do and I never did. And if I don't do it now, you know, I will always regret it.
Yes, you will always regret it. I don't have any regrets, fortunately, because I did travel at all the places I wanted to go to. And I don't honestly have any regrets now. But I do miss things. I miss being able to get in a car and go to places. I miss not being able to go to Walmer Castle, for example, and do my Christmas shopping there. Things like that. Yeah. Stupid things, really.
Yeah. But this notion of home, I think, is a really interesting one. Because, I'm from Cardiff, but there are lots of other places, I suppose including Canterbury, you know, where I am now, that I would call home. But is home almost this sort of, this place of origin? Is it a place to which we return? I suppose it's very much linked with this notion of nostalgia as well. But would you consider any of the places that you've lived to be more home-like than others?
No, I wouldn't, actually. Everywhere we've lived, and we've lived in a lot of houses, I should imagine, has been home, because that's what you make it. Home is what you make it. And I've always been glad to go home wherever I am. So that's
good. And I suppose for some people as well, home isn't necessarily the place where you sleep of an evening. In a way, it can be a place of sanctuary. It can be a place that is maybe a stopping point. You know, it can take different forms, because often, of course, it may be your proximity to other people. It may be the people who comprise that, rather than necessarily the bricks and mortar building.
Yes, I agree with you. We did have great fun living in London, I must admit. And I enjoyed working for the City of London, very much so. And that was a shame we had to give that up. But then I had found this wonderful property in Netherstowe, you see, that we had been looking for 20 years. And suddenly there it was.
But the City of London, I mean, yes, I can imagine that might not appeal to the same degree.
Well, it doesn't. Well, not now, because I realise now that sort of City of London is not meant for old people. But we were very safe on the Barbican estate, because you just walked out and you had everything there. You know, there was a theatre, there was library, there was all sorts of things. And it was just great. And we did miss that I miss.
Yeah. Were there particular shows, any particular performances that really stand out from that period?
Yes, I went to see a Julius Caesar, and I played hooky from work, so I got a £5 ticket, and they put me right in the front of the audience, and there was so much blood on stage. Yeah. I can't remember. That's what.
So did you feel that was a punishment for taking time off work?
Yes, I did.
That you were being punished by actually having all the blood spraying in your face from the performance.
I did indeed. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
But that's all that stands out, really.
Yeah, because your daughter, of course, does so much pantomime work. Now, is that something that runs in the family? Is that something...
No, that's something that she has done on her own, I'm afraid. I think she's wonderful, actually.
Yeah. Oh, no, I've said, and I think I said it when I interviewed her a couple of years ago, and I'm happy for this to be on the record, that the Ash Panto, and my children have said the same thing, that it's a far more, in some ways, I mean, it's a different experience to maybe the Marlowe pantomime, but it's just incredible the way that it's done. I mean, for a small venue, it's all done there.
She angsts about it all year, you know. And we listen to it and we throw in ideas and everything else. And she takes things on board and she puts things in and she takes things out. She's wonderful, actually, the way she does that.
And is it very much a collaborative effort in that sense? So you're involved in that as well. Do you read the scripts? Do you help with the design of the panto?
No, I don't help with the design. I just help with, oh, that would be a good song if you did that here, or if you did that here, or if you did this there, or whatever. That's all we do.
Yeah. But often that's the best way, and also that sort of sharing experience. It's interesting you say that, but because she writes so beautifully, the angst, of course, is probably part of the process, even though you know, and you know, on some level you think that she would know that she's very good at it. But of course, I suppose it's the King Midas thing as well. You know, you're always a little bit worried that, you know, you may not strike gold twice, but inevitably, but in the right conditions,
she
do.
Does. But she does angst about it, bless her.
And so we started by talking about education, and you mentioned Glenys Kinnock as well. I mean, have you found over the years that the changes in educational ethos, I'm just thinking of what I was used to, I don't know what it was like in Bermuda, but the sort of experiences I grew up with in the 1980s, you know, the impact they have on generations. Do you sort of see that education has improved in many ways, or has it improved only for perhaps more privileged, you know, for particular types of children? Because my children are doing things in school which I don't recall ever doing, certainly not in primary school.
Well, I don't know much about education really now, to be honest. My children all went to private schools.
Okay.
And that was a decision we made early on in our marriage because I felt I was teaching in a state school at the time that they didn't get all the benefits that they could have got. And that's why I wanted them to go to private school. But, yes, it has changed. But I don't know whether it's for the best or not, because I'm no longer a teacher.
But for you to have been teaching in the state sector and drawing the conclusion that that is not the right environment for your children, that's a huge indictment of the education system of its day.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yes, it is, actually. I felt that they could get more chance, more opportunities if they went to private school. I don't know whether it's because they've all sort of rebelled against that, and they've all sent their children to state schools. It's interesting. Except for my daughter who works in Lithuania. She works in an English school. And her daughter goes to a sort of kindergarten part of the school. And she wears a uniform and everything else.
Yeah. But often there are two things there. First of all, it may be that the educational standards are very different in a good way from back then. But also it shows, doesn't it, that, and this is a healthy thing, that you might send your children to be educated in a certain way, but they will make their own decisions. The fact that they can make those decisions, because surely that's also what education is about. That you give them the tools to be able to choose what is right for them.
Absolutely, and they must choose. They must choose how they celebrate Christmas, how they celebrate anything in their life, and how they look after their children. And that's what I wanted to give them. I wanted to give them choice. I wanted to give them, which I didn't feel you had in state schools. I felt it was very regimented. Even before the children, all this, because anybody was whipped away who didn't conform. I felt they should have the choice.
Because I was just about to ask you, whether there were any teachers who inspired you, because you mentioned that you didn't want to be a teacher like the teachers who taught you. But were there any teachers who were good role models?
Not really. I mean, I had friends whose parents were teachers, I suppose, at school. There was one teacher that I think, I can't remember what she taught now. I don't think she actually taught me, but she was just happened to be the mother of a friend of mine whose husband had been killed in Korea, and so I remember her. And years later, I bumped into the daughter when my youngest was in hospital because she was a nurse at the hospital. But apart from that, I haven't got any teachers that were good role models, I'm afraid.
So was that a big driver for you, do you think, that you thought, right, I'm going to do this so well and so differently? And that was the sort of...
It's that thing
about getting up early in the morning.
It was probably that was the very reason.
That was the thing. There has to be a reason, a rationale. If I can't see that in somebody, I can't hook with that person. I need to see the passion, but I want to sort of see that this is why the person does. No matter how eccentric it is or how bewildering it is or how alien it is, I want to see the way that... It's like they can't do it otherwise.
That's why I think I was quite willing to do what my father suggested.
Yeah.
Because I was determined, even though I'd gone to an all-girls school, mind you, and it had been satisfactory, but it hadn't been wonderful. There was nobody who inspired me, really. The only one who... Actually, I make a mistake there. The only one who inspired me was fired.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
Because she was a dance teacher, and we learnt to dance. We were doing dance to West Side Story, which was quite something, quite avant-garde at the time. And that was considered too much.
So she was fired because she was teaching West Side Story.
Mm.
Gosh, it's a different world now. I was waiting for some great conspiracy, some great crime. That doesn't quite... No. I mean, but that's shocking. I wonder what happened to that teacher who...
Let's hope she went on to teach it somewhere else.
Yeah, well, yes, indeed.
Because it was wonderful, and it was so liberating. I remember that much. It was liberating. So, therefore, I wanted to be like her. I wanted to be someone special that children would remember.
Yeah. Well, it's the best education when you know, or you don't even know that you're being educated, because it falls into place so naturally that it's the right thing, that you're enjoying it. I say to my students, I hope you enjoy the lecture. And then I often think, that's funny, because if somebody had said that to me when I was at school, it would have felt very odd, like, enjoy, you're not allowed to enjoy school. But if you do enjoy school, well, all the more reason that you'll turn up the next morning and the morning after that.
That's true.
So it's a completely different way of doing things, and it's just a very careful shift of the axis. It's just saying, not so much there's a curriculum you have to study, you have to do ABC, but actually suddenly make it clear that the students will actually benefit from doing this rather than doing it by rote.
They do it by rote now. They do. They have, everything is prescribed, at least it was last time I went down and did some supply work. Everything was prescribed, and if you didn't follow the prescription, you were in trouble. Yeah. The teachers literally had to sort of, on Wednesday you do this, and on Thursday you do that. And if the supply teacher came in and did it on Tuesday, and it should have been done on a Thursday, lo and behold, you were in a lot of trouble.
But also from the children's point of view, because I remember my daughter, who was very much looking forward to, maybe a bit apprehensive, about a particular presentation she had to do, or, she was probably only about 6 at the time. And it was a big deal. Maybe it was one of those, talk about your family, or just one of those moments when you say something about who you are and what your parents do, show and tell or whatever it's called, and she was all looking forward to it. And then the teacher who was there the next day wasn't the one they were expecting and didn't follow the rubric, or maybe selected a different child to do the exercise, even though it was her turn. So suddenly, and you know, that's the bit that she remembered, that the moment when she was all ready to do this great job.
I can understand.
And it never happened.
I can understand, yeah. Because I got into trouble a couple of times because I did things at the wrong time.
Yeah.
I did things that I remembered from the curriculum that they said you had to do, but I did them at the wrong time, apparently, and that meant that the teacher coming back wouldn't be able to do them and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Gosh. Happy so days or not. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So teaching is very different now from what it used to be.
Yeah. And a few more questions, Sally, as we start to wrap up. I mean, would you say that your memories, as you look back on your life and career, are predominantly positive ones? Can you see the positive out of all the things, the good and the bad?
Yes, I can see the positive, I'm afraid. And I'm sorry, I'm not being very forthcoming, I don't think.
No, you have been. Very much so.
Yeah. But, yes, I can see the positive things.
Yeah. But I always think, when sometimes things, you know, the whole accentuating the negative sometimes, you know, can you learn from those negative experiences? I mean, you've answered that one by showing how you said, right, you know, I'm going to be a teacher, but I'm going to be a better teacher and a different teacher than the ones that I grew up with. And then that's the inspiration to allow you to, you know, weave your way through your career.
Yes, yes. And it's been an exciting career, you know, because I started off as teacher and then I worked as an aquarium. And then I worked in the City of London. And in between I did supply teaching. So I was always working part-time to help with finances, of course, and the school fees, because I'd insisted on the children going to schools.
Do you think your younger self could ever have imagined, because I know you said you wanted to work in an antiques store, but could your younger self ever have imagined that you'd have lived the life that you have?
No, no.
They wouldn't recognise you?
No, they wouldn't recognise what I'd achieved.
Yeah.
And I don't think my parents would either. Neither my mother nor my father would recognise what I'd achieved.
Yeah. And are you in touch with anybody from that era? I mean, I don't know if social media has enabled opportunities.
No, not really. No. And we had a school reunion about after 50 years, but I fell down. I went to visit a friend and fell in her rhubarb patch. And so I couldn't go to the reunion.
Yeah.
And it was mostly boarders anyway.
Yeah.
I did go in the end. And sat with my leg up and a great big bag of peas on it. And but it was mostly boarders.
Because there's always that thing, isn't there, about going back and whether you feel... Maybe you don't need to do it when you're older, but that need to impress, that need almost to show off, almost to say, look what I've attained, because you're aware of that maybe other people have done better than you.
I used to do that, but I don't do it anymore, yeah. I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing.
Yes. And I do have a friend, as you say, goes back to those days.
Yeah.
Hilly and I have been friends for over 50 years, I think. Her husband, sadly, has Parkinson's now, so we just keep in touch via email, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, I've got one more question to ask you, Sally, which is whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Neither, I think. I don't look forward much to the future, and I certainly don't look back. Well, perhaps I do look back a little bit.
Well, it has been phenomenal to hear your story. You've taken me on a journey and it's been a compelling narrative. Sally, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you.